I think we're ready. The next argued case is number 22-1365, Kelly against the United States. Mr. Manny.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Jason Manapors, and I represent Matthew Kelly, the veteran. Following a favorable decision by the Naval Discharge Review Board, which acts on behalf of the Secretary, Kelly was issued a revised certificate of discharge. The certificate is found on page 1153 of your appendix. In box 25, the word separation authority, under the word separation authority, is a change in code of what's called the MIL-PERSMAN, the Military Personnel Manual. Now I'm going to refer to these as regulations. I'm going to refer to all of these as regulations, and we can have a discussion as to whether or not
they... Let me ask you a threshold issue,
yes,
in my mind anyway. This case is about military retirement, correct?
Yes, sir.
And we also have jurisdiction over veteran cases that deal with disability benefits for a veteran. One of the issues here is whether there's a property interest in this military retirement, just as I think we've ruled in the past that there exists in veterans' disability. Can you address that question?
Well, yes. I mean, that's the due process issue. And I relied on Cushman, and the trial judge cited some cases which, as I review them, and they don't see an apposite, and the government has cited some cases, none of which seem apposite. I mean, it's sort of inconsistent for the trial judge to say that 10 U.S.C. 1201 is a money-mandating statute and then say at the same time that it doesn't provide a property right. I mean, if it's a money-mandating statute, that means there's
So I've looked into the difference in the terminology in the text of the statute. What I don't understand is why should there be a difference between military retirement and veterans' benefits?
Well, you made my case for me, Your Honor. That's the question.
No, I'm asking you to make.
There shouldn't be. There shouldn't be. There shouldn't be. If the statute regarding military disability benefits provides a non-discretionary obligation on the part of the military to provide disability benefits if a member meets certain criteria. The criteria are set out in the SECNAV instruction, which I said is going to refer to as a regulation without discussing exactly what it is. But you treat it as a regulation. You'll call it a regulation probably in your opinion. You have in the past. So we'll call it a regulation. The government certainly is not going to dispute that they're not bound by it. And that SECNAV instruction is non-discretionary. If you meet the criteria under the SECNAV instruction, you get disability benefits. So, I mean, Judge Rainey, your question, as I said, should be prepared to the government, because I don't think anything they've cited or the trial judge has cited distinguish this case from Cushman on due process grounds. What I started to say on the issue of the change in authority was the government acknowledges that this code changed Mr. Kelly's narrative, reason for separation, to best interest of the government. In other words, it was no longer a misconduct separation, and it was retroactive. It was a retroactive change. Now, the Navy regulation at paragraph 1002, and that's on page 110 of the appendix, states, and I'm just one sentence.
Is it clear that it was intended to be retroactive?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's a new DD-214 form. I mean, everything else on the form lists as it's a substitute thing. He gets a new, when he was given the new DD-214, he got a new certificate of discharge.
Where's the support for that conclusion you're offering?
Oh, this is one of those things that I think you, you know, familiarity breeds contempt. You just have to know it. If you take a look at the certificate.
We have to base our decision on the record.
I know you are. And you're going to take a look at the DD-214 form. And you'll see that it says date entered, active duty, separation date, active duty. Certainly the narrative reason for separation and the separation authority, which says MIL-PERSMAN 1910-164. I mean, how can that not be retroactive? I mean, they changed his separation authority.
Excuse me. It's administrative, right? Isn't the reason for the removal was changed to administrative? Is that correct?
No, best interests of the service. It was changed from serious misconduct to best interests of the service.
So it wasn't changed to disability retirement or something?
That's what we're arguing about.
I know that's what we're arguing about, but I just wanted to make sure and just clarify that that doesn't answer the question before us today.
No, but what answers the, what it does say is my fundamental argument, which is, and I started to quote from you paragraph 1002 of the SECNAV instruction, which says, when a punitive discharge or administrative discharge for misconduct does not result in disability processing, disability processing shall be resumed and completed. And what we've said is that all the board has discussed...
Can I ask you a question just so I make sure I'm following along with you? Are you referring to the SECNAV that's in the appendix?
Yes.
Could you tell me what specific page you're looking at, please?
The SECNAV instruction I'm reading from is on page 110 of the appendix.
Okay, is there a particular place?
Pardon?
Okay, 1002.
1002 is the section page. The appendix page is 110.
I get it. Is there a particular part I should be looking at?
Yes, the very last section of 1002. Let me open it up to just make sure I don't misquote it.
What's the page number again?
It's as I said. It's page 110 of the appendix, and it is on. Why is I not finding my tab? It is the very last sentence of section 1002.
It says, when a punitive discharge or administrative discharge for misconduct does not result, disability processing shall be resumed and completed.
That's correct, Your Honor. And what I'm saying is that the board had an obligation to at least explain why the revised DD-214 and the fact that he now is separated for the best interest of the service does not make him eligible for disability benefits if he met the disability threshold, which the member was vacated by the trial court, the decision that he did not. Okay. So the Frizzell rule, which I'm urging you to adopt today in this circuit, was established by the District of Columbia Court of Appeals. It's actually just a single sentence in the larger Frizzell opinion, which I will quote, which says that the board's decision was arbitrary because it, quote, did not respond to two of Frizzell's arguments which did not appear frivolous on their face and could affect the board's decision. This is what is called the fourth.
Which argument are you contending was
in? We're contending that the board did not address the argument that while it may not have been an injustice back then, because his discharge status was changed to being an honorable, misconduct was struck, and best interest of the service was substituted, that with those three changes, it's unjust now. In other words, the board needed to discuss why was it not unjust after the changes were made so that he no longer had been separated for misconduct. That's the, and we're saying that they did not comply with the Frizzell rule, and we're arguing that this court ought to adopt the Frizzell rule. I noted that the Court of Federal Claims has adopted the Frizzell rule, and although Frizzell itself does not explain the rationale for the rule that military decisions are given deference is a judge-made rule, and Frizzell certainly makes sense to counterbalance that rule.
Does the APA apply to the board's decision?
Oh, what a question. technically, no. Realistically, yes. I mean, that's a thicket in which I don't want to get into. I mean, why don't I want to get into it? Because if you characterize it as an APA claim, the Court of Federal Claims will say, well, we don't have jurisdiction over APA claims. But as a practical matter, the Court of Federal Claims in conducting judgment for administrative on the record will apply APA standards. So that's why I'm sort of moaning here that you asked, Your Honor, asked the question.
Would a due process claim within this claim, wouldn't just the due process invoke the APA?
Yes, there was a due process claim in addition to the APA in quotes. In addition to the Frizzell rule, the government cited the regulation 723.3. This is part of the board's regulations, 32 CFR 723.3. And I acknowledge that I didn't bring that up. It was the government who inserted it into this case. And as you look at that regulation, it requires the board to address all claims of constitutional, statutory, regular violations and recite all the essential facts on which a denial was based. So even if you don't adopt the Frizzell rule, you still have 723.3 and the issue of what are all the essential facts. And certainly one of the essential facts is that his narrative reason for separation was changed, and that is his service-connected disabilities contributed to his misconduct. I want to make very clear, Your Honors, that there is no regulation allowing the board or the Navy to deny disability unless a misconduct separation results. The definition of misconduct found in the SECNAV says you can be denied disability benefits
It can be denied if the disability didn't arise in the line of duty, too.
That's exactly what I was going to say. That's where the misconduct applies in. But this isn't a line of duty injury.
You have limited time, so let me ask a question that really matters to me. In Section 1201 and the issue of whether there's a mandate in there, a money mandate, that provides a private interest similar to what we have said before exists with respect to veterans' claims. A property interest. If we were to find that there's a property interest in military retirement benefits, how does that change? Now, I know it alters completely your case. I want to understand from your perspective, in what ways does it, what happens after that?
What happens after that is, unless you want to venture into it, is the trial judge has to determine how much process is
due. So we'd have to remand, number one.
Yes, you'd have to remand it. And then the trial judge would have to determine, is this the type of situation where the board could make its credibility determinations based solely on the police report, or did Kelly have to have an obligation to tell his side of the story? As I emphasized, all the board had was the police report, okay? And although the police report has things that are very favorable to Kelly,
so there would be a remand on this particular issue.
That's right, and the trial judge would decide how much process is due. In other words, was the board required to provide an in-person hearing? Now, there's a footnote because the clerk wouldn't allow me to attach the FOIA response. You can peek at it if it wasn't deliberate. You can peek at it if you want because it's attached to the non-compliant brief and that's visible. But the board has granted, I think, two hearings in 7 years. Two hearings in thousands of cases in 7 years. They don't like to do hearings. So, I mean, this is something serious for the Navy if they have to grant personal hearings before the BCNO when credibility is at issue. On the other hand, the VA does it. Welfare departments do it. Social Security does it. Everybody else does it. Why should the military be exempt? Yes. I mean, but the board does not like to grant hearings. Professor Fidel used to say, Judge.
Just trying to follow the train of thought that we're going down. If, in fact, the change of status is deemed retroactive, is any of these other conditions relevant anymore?
I don't understand the question.
As to whether he was properly considered at the initial discharge.
I don't think so. You have the disability issue, which the trial judge reversed on, and then there's the misconduct issue, and as I've been discussing with Judge Reyna, there is no authority to just say, well, he had gotten an altercation to police, so we're going to deny him disability benefits unless there was a misconduct discharge, and there's no longer a misconduct discharge.
Well, that was my question. Is that still a factor if, in fact, or as a matter of law and as a matter of the statutory procedures, the change of status is retroactive?
You know, Judge, I've struggled with that. I mean, I presented this as an explanation issue because there are always corner cases, and I was sitting there struggling with the fact is, could there be a corner case where the misconduct was so heinous that the board would deny disability benefits and be sustained even with the change of character of service. And that's why I presented it as an explanation. I wasn't going to foreclose, I didn't think I could foresay absolutely positively the change in character of service drove the result positively, but it certainly should. It certainly should. And any case where...
Do you have any cases where that has occurred? I mean, I'm struggling like
it's,
Judge
it's a
Newman
corner case. I'm thinking of murderers and stuff like that.
Well, the problem is that obviously that's not what was done here. Mm-hmm. Instead, they looked at whether an injustice occurred at the time, right?
And they should have looked at whether an injustice exists
with the change
now.
But you don't have any support for saying that's the way. I mean, that's my question to you. What is your legal support for saying that that's how they should have analyzed the case?
That's why I argued it as an explanation case. That's why I argued it as an explanation case. In other words,
what do you mean? What's an explanation case?
Well, his DD 214, we haven't gotten into that, and I'm not going to have the authority, the time to
Are
get
you
there.
You saying this is a case of first impression?
Let me answer that question. His DD 214 clearly said, excuse me, his DD 149 form, and that's on page 1010 of the appendix. That's the form he filed to begin the review with the board. Said in relevant part, given the DRB finding that an applicant warranted a fully honorable discharge, and his VA rating, military retirement, uses VA criteria, he should get his 60% military medical retirement pay. So his issue that he presented was that given the DRB finding, he should get his pay. Okay? And
you're
the board,
saying there's a lack of explanation saying it doesn't matter, it's not retroactive for purposes of disability retirement. That's
they
what
need
you're,
to
you want an explanation.
They
That's
need to explain mean. Why they're looking at the original separation rather than the change. That's okay. What... Okay. I'm out of time. Does the court have any other questions?
We'll save you rebuttal time. I think we're ready to hear from the other side.
Thank you.
Mr. Rao.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Mr. Kelly concedes that the Navy did not err in administratively separating him from misconduct in 2013. So the primary issue in this case is whether the BCNR rationally determined that there was no injustice in Mr. Kelly's separation from the Navy without a disability retirement. And the trial court correctly concluded that the BCNR rationally determined that it was not an injustice because Mr. Kelly was ineligible for disability retirement processing at the time of his separation due to the administrative separation proceedings that resulted from Mr. Kelly's conscious decisions to commit alcohol-related misconduct, including disorderly conduct and resisting
arrest. Mr. Kelly's status, the characterization of his discharge, at the first time that happened, it's only happened once, but when he was first discharged, and there's a characterization of his discharge, that was later changed, correct?
The NDRB, for equitable reasons, upgraded his discharge.
In a way, his discharge was upgraded. He got a promotion in his discharge.
His discharge was upgraded by the NDRB, and that was...
You're saying it's okay for the board not to consider that?
No, the board did consider that. The board expressly stated in its decision that in 2015, the Naval Discharge Review Board upgraded your characterization of service to honorable and changed your narrative reason for separation to secretarial authority based on equity reasons related to your diving-related medical diagnoses. The board expressly stated...
But did they explain why that wasn't sufficient as an explanation for why it would be unjust to now not allow him to have retirement benefits?
Yes. So the board
did they say?
Right. The board explained, this is all at Appendix 1006. It said, the board agreed with the analysis provided by the Naval Discharge Review Board that the Naval Academy properly processed and discharged you for misconduct. The board found no evidence that supported an argument that you were not criminally responsible for your misconduct and noted that there was no evidence for...
looking at the time. Isn't that looking at the time of the before the correction or no?
Well, it's looking at the fact that the Naval Discharge Review Board found no error in his separation. For purely equitable reasons, it decided a couple years later to upgrade his discharge. So the question now becomes, does that compel the BCNR to say it's an injustice that he doesn't get a disability retirement if he was in fact unfit for duty.
There was a reason for the board to change its mind.
But the discharge review board, yes, for purely equitable reasons. Again,
equitable reason, but they did have a reason.
Yes.
Why shouldn't that reason apply back to the initial characterization of his discharge?
Well, because the BCNR here made a rational decision that it was not required to it was not required to grant him a disability retirement simply because his cognitive issues may have contributed to his misconduct. Rather, the board.
So that's the reason that they provided, that the board provided, that at the time of the initial characterization or the discharge, the board was unaware, or the service was unaware, of the connection between his service-connected, I'm going to use veteran law term, but his disability that arose in the line of duty and the behavior for which he was discharged. Later, there's an understanding as to the behavior, what drove it, and that caused the board to change the characterization of his discharge. Correct?
The discharge review board, yes, as a matter of equity, it decided to.
And the board, and your argument is that, well, we can't do anything about it because at the time that he was initially discharged, we didn't know that he had this medical condition.
If by we you mean the BCNR, no. What the BCNR...
Your client.
Right, so it's not that the BCNR could not have given him a disability retirement if it found that he were unfit. It's that it made the equitable determination that it was not an injustice for somebody who was lawfully separated from the service for serious misconduct for him not to get a disability retirement when he was in fact ineligible at the time of separation because of this serious misconduct.
The basis for that ineligibility was changed. It altered.
For purely equitable reasons, though. The NDRB simply determined that as a matter of equity, it was going to grant him an upgrade in characterization of service and change the narrative reason.
Okay. Let me ask you a question. Are you familiar with the case Kelly versus U.S. 22-1365?
I don't believe so. Ring a bell.
It's a case that identifies military retirement benefits as mandatory. And if that's the case, then why should we not find that it's also mandatory under the military retirement system?
Well, ordinarily, if somebody
was all this argument about whether Section 1201 is mandating or not.
And we don't dispute that Section 1201 is a money mandating statute.
You don't?
No. I think that established.
You would agree that the government is required by law to provide benefits if the soldier is able to demonstrate eligibility?
Well, not if they were ineligible for disability processing. There's regulations in the service. The Navy has one of them here, or at least had one of them, that if you are subject to administrative separation proceedings for misconduct.
The reason I ask is this goes to the question of due process.
Right. Yes, and although it's been, this court has held that it's a money mandating statute, 1201. It's never held that, as far as I'm aware, that military disability retirements, that there's a due process property interest.
I invite you to look at Kelly versus U.S. What happens if we determine that it is mandating, that Section 1201 is mandating?
Well, if the result of that were to be, As Mr. Kelly seems to argue, that the board would have to grant a hearing in every disability retirement case. I mean, that would just grind grind the board's business to a halt, most likely. We don't think that's what that would require, as we've contended in our brief. Even if the court were to find that Mr. Kelly had a property interest in a disability retirement, that it's still discretionary whether the board needs to grant a hearing or not. There's several cases from the predecessor court, finding that it was not arbitrary and capricious to deny a hearing in disability retirement cases. That's a matter within the board's discretion. So, and that's another reason why the due process, even if the court were to...
And that's because it was determined that that type of benefit was not a property interest.
No, I don't think that was the basis of those cases. Simply that the board has discretion as to whether or not to grant a hearing. It's not. I think the Flute case that we cited, that didn't involve a disability retirement, I don't believe. But I mean, it said that it's not necessarily a due process violation for the board not to grant a hearing. It's a matter of discretion.
Are you aware of any case where the soldier has been granted a hearing after the fact, where the board decides, yes, let's go ahead and have a hearing?
I believe there's probably cases, published cases, where that's happened. I'm not disputing that it's uncommon for the board to grant hearings. If it granted hearings in every case, then there's already complaints that the process is slow enough, and to then grant hearings in every case would slow down the process significantly more. So, if that were the holding, that the board needs to grant a hearing every time there's a disability retirement claim, that would be severely problematic for the government, for the board, and for the veterans.
Not for the soldiers.
No,
right?
for the soldiers, yes, because I mean there's requirements that I think a certain percentage of cases are supposed to be decided within 10 months. The boards are already routinely going past that, and so to then add a hearing requirement to that, it's going to delay the ability of soldiers who are entitled to relief to get it, and so it would be problematic for the soldiers as well, if that were the case. So again, this wasn't a situation where the BCNR ignored the NDRB's decision. The BCNR's decision, it's consistent with the NDRB's decision, where the NDRB concluded that failing to pay for food and drink at a local restaurant in a timely manner, disorderly conduct, and resisting arrest were all conscious decisions that violate the tenets of honorable and faithful service.
What about just want to make sure I understand. What do you think they said in response to the argument that, his misconduct was based on his disability and his self-medicating through alcoholism and such, through alcohol, I just don't necessarily see a direct response to that. Do you?
Well, the standard that the board put in here for whether or not there would have been an injustice in Mr. Kelly's case was whether he was criminally responsible for his misconduct or whether there was any mental incompetence, and it found that there was not. And that's in the injustice context, that's well within the board's discretion.
So what was the standard for mental incompetence that it was looking at? Did it consider his traumatic brain injury? Did it consider his depression? Did it consider the other illnesses that were identified in the records?
Well,
just don't see where it's addressed.
The term not criminally responsible, it's really a term of art, meaning substantial capacity to either appreciate the criminality of the conduct or conform the conduct to the law. And the board found that there was no evidence that Mr. Kelly couldn't do that. In fact, he said himself that he simply behaved stupidly at the restaurant incident. That's at Appendix 1385. When he was resisting arrest and acting in a disorderly manner.
So the response is that it doesn't matter. I guess I'm supposed to infer from what you're saying that he should infer that those arguments weren't convincing and they don't matter. it doesn't matter that he was self-medicating with alcohol. It doesn't matter that he had depression. It doesn't matter that he had a traumatic brain injury in the line of duty. None of that's discussed, but I'm supposed to just understand that it didn't matter because of the standard that the board applied, which is the kind of misconduct that would allow you to get away with a crime.
Yes, because Your Honor, the board determined in the context of whether this was an injustice that the fact that it was that his cognitive issues may have contributed to his misconduct, that wasn't sufficient for it to be an injustice that he doesn't receive a disability.
I don't see where they said what you're saying right now.
Well, they acknowledge what the NDRB said, that he was upgraded based on equity reasons related to your diving related medical diagnoses.
Is this board decision representative in your experience of the kind of detailed explanation provided by the board usually?
It depends on the board, I think. In the Navy's case, there is a requirement that they provide a brief statement of the reasons. So I guess under the regulations, brevity is encouraged for BCNR decisions in particular. Other boards typically have longer.
What is the standard of review that we are to apply to this?
It's the APA standard of review, arbitrary and capricious.
I'm just wondering, how is a reviewing court supposed to review something that's brief and given that brevity and understand that it's not arbitrary and capricious if the full reasons aren't provided or all the arguments aren't addressed?
Well, I mean, even Mr. Kelly's own opening brief acknowledged that the court can affirm a decision of less than ideal clarity as long as the basis is reasonably discernible from the record.
So that's the question, is whether the basis is reasonably discernible.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
I only have a few seconds left, so unless the court has any further questions, respectfully request that the court affirm the judgment of the court.
Yes, Mr. Manning, you have your rebuttal, John.
Oh, you're giving me 5 minutes. That's very nice. Just three very short points, and we can all go to lunch. First, there's been no mention of Rob O'Neill's involvement in here. Judge Rano, you'll remember Captain O'Neill from the Strand case. You were on that panel. He was executive director of the board back then. We don't have a record on it because the government didn't disclose his involvement, but there's certainly something strange about Mr. O'Neill, something inappropriate about Mr. O'Neill being involved in the separation of Mr. Kelly, and then when it comes to the board, for him being the examiner that helps adjudicate his case. What's the saying? No man should be the judge of his own actions. It certainly looks to me like, and maybe I'm wrong, Captain O'Neill decided to have the last word on a discipline that he was involved in having caused at the academy. The court did not take my suggestion that you issue a letter directing the government to explain what Mr. O'Neill's or Captain O'Neill's involvement here was. I don't want to denigrate Captain O'Neill. If you look at his LinkedIn profile, which I did, he has an extraordinary military career, but he just shouldn't have been involved in this case. You shouldn't be involved in separating a member and then adjudicating his appeal. None of you would let your law clerks do that. And I guess at this stage, the best I can ask you to do is drop a footnote disapproving of that arrangement, because all they've admitted is that he is, in fact, one and the same person. Criminality, if the board relied on the alleged criminality, but the record shows that Kelly disputed it, and that's where the due process issue comes in. If you're going to rely on criminality, he needs to have an opportunity to tell his side of the story. The DRB brief is in the appendix, and in that DRB brief, I represented him before the DRB. I did not represent him before the BCNR. We explained that he disputed the criminality of his actions. I think our contention was that he was, you know, if you read the police report, which again is only one side of the story, basically the Annapolis police were trying to resolve a collection problem for a local vendor, and he did not want to provide his ID. Well, a lot of military people don't want to provide their ID to people who they don't know, for good reasons. For good reasons. This man was a frontline warrior. He was involved when he was overseas in underwater demolition. He may have had a good reason he should tell that side of the story. And the other, the final point I'll have, Judge, is this issue of incompetence. I don't know where that standard come from. The incompetence standard is defined in the regulation as financial incompetence. So when the board said there's no evidence of you being incompetent, where does that standard come from? Why isn't the standard, did your service-connected disabilities contribute to your misconduct? The board does not explain that, which then ties back into my argument that of the Frizzell rule. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you. The case is under submission.